Well, this is an exciting session for me, having read both of these books years ago and finding them really influential in my life and my studies. This session is a psychobiography of Joseph Smith, Two Secular Views United, featuring the authors of these two books. First of all, we've got Dr. Robert Anderson, who authored Inside the Mind of Joseph Smith, Psychobiography, and the Book of Mormon. After retiring from full-time psychiatric practice, Dr. Robert Anderson now does temporary assignments with inner-city mental hygiene clinics and Native Americans. He is the author of this book, Inside the Mind of Joseph Smith, and of articles in the American Journal of Psychiatry and in Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon Thought, and the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal, and articles on Mormonism in the psychoanalytic journal Cleo's Psyche. He has presented at the John Whitmer Historical Association and a half a dozen times at Salt Lake City Sunstone, where I've seen him and heard him before. He characterizes himself as a non-believing Mormon, desiring to assist the church in its continuous and necessary evolution. I like that a lot. The integration of the Mormon psyche. And should I introduce Dr. Moraine now, also, before we begin? Let me introduce both of you, and then I'll turn it over to Bob. Our other distinguished panelist is Dr. William Moraine, who is the author of this book, The Sword of Laban, Joseph Smith, Jr., and the Dissociated Mind. Dr. Moraine is a retired professor of plastic surgery at Dartmouth Medical School. He's presently engaged in numerous community development activities in Iowa. He attended Graceland College, Grinnell College, and Harvard Medical School, and he did his residency training at Harvard and Stanford. And after a 20-year career as a professor of plastic surgery at Dartmouth Medical School, he is retired, and he is he's writing and authoring a number of articles, including he's authored over 200 scientific and public interest articles. He's presented frequently at Sunstone and JWHA and MHA and Restoration Studies Symposium. He also is currently the editor of the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. So I'm going to turn this over to Robert Anderson first, and then we'll hear from Bill Moraine.
Guess here.
You might want to put it as close to your mouth as possible. It doesn't pick up real well.
How is that? Good? Okay. This paper began with a curious fact in the Book of Mormon, and that is the date of the crucifixion of Jesus is given not only as a year and a month, but a year, month, and day. And I wondered how many times does this happen in the Book of Mormon? The title of the paper is A Brief Psychobiographic Inquiry into Joseph Smith with Examples from the Book of Mormon. Psychobiography began with Freud's 1910 attempt to understand Leonardo da Vinci and his childhood dream. In Freud's paper, a vulture kept sticking his tail feathers into the mouth of Leonardo, and Freud connected this dream with Leonardo's possible homosexuality. The paper by Freud contained both the promise and failings of psychobiography. He used a German translation that erroneously stated that the bird with the feathers was a vulture. A correct translation of the word nibbio is a bird of prey called a kite, and this changes what conclusions one could draw from the dream. Freud continued psychobiography with other subjects, and his followers quickly saw that the value of depth inquiry into the biographies of historical individuals, especially writers. There are now thousands of works in psychobiography and psychohistory. Some are absolutely marvelous. Fawn Brody's deservedly honored biography of Joseph Smith, despite being labeled psychobiography, is hardly that, but is instead filled with common sense. For those who have an absolute testimony, of the divinity of the Book of Mormon, or of the prophetic calling of Joseph Smith, the psychobiography of Joseph Smith is of little interest or use. At best, its purveyors may be felt as irritating in raising fraudulent questions about the divinity of the gospel. For those of a more questioning spirit, their introspections may raise some doubts to the experience of the testimony. One might wonder what part psychological issues may have contributed in creating a testimony, including his or her family background and the universal wish for comfort and security in life and in overcoming death. They may feel challenged with the cognitive dissonance between their secure beliefs and the contradicting external evidence concerning the Book of Abraham or the Book of Mormon. Psychobiography may extend their doubts. For those with even greater doubt concerning these two books of Scripture, questions may remain for how they were created. Here, psychobiography may provide useful explanations. In all of those with a questioning spirit, exploration may lead to modified or broadening views of religion and alter methods of participation within Mormonism. Introduction. In the late 1960s, new historical information developed concerning the Book of Abraham, the date of the Palmyra Revival, earlier versions of the first vision story, and added information concerning the 1826 pretrial of Joseph Smith. I backed away from participation in Mormonism for 20 years, but I began to wonder if I had the ability to understand the Book of Mormon as a disguised autobiography. Further, would its history qualify for a formal psychiatric diagnosis of Joseph Smith? I returned to the study of Mormonism. What I did not know was that Dr. Moraine, during the same period of time, was working on the same issue. Independently, we both realized that in the first story of Laban and Asor, Joseph Smith was reworking, in fantasy and concrete form, his childhood leg surgery. The surgeon's knife became Laban's sword, the surgeon became the evil Laban, and wine was part of both the real and fantasy stories. Joseph Smith destroyed the surgeon who gave him more physical pain than he had ever experienced in his life. The usual explanation for difficult behaviors or verbal interactions in the documented history of Joseph Smith is that he was forced by commandments from God. Unfortunately, the supernatural can be used to explain and justify anything. I took as a strict hypothesis that his life in the Book of Mormon could be understood completely naturalistically. This is the position of science and academic history, for the supernatural cannot be studied scientifically. And history, built on supernatural claims, disallows communication between scientists of various religious beliefs. The first requirement for doing psychobiography is to get facts, facts, and more facts. The first fact is that his claim to supernaturally translate ancient Egyptian has been countered by the rediscovered papyrus. And the second is that there is no evidence anywhere for the Book of Mormon story. No psychobiography of Smith could have been done without the corrected history that has been mostly provided by non-believers. These include the delayed creation and variations of his first vision story, knowledge about his involvement in the world of magic and accounts of his devastating 1826 court pretrial, his confession to his father-in-law that he could not see in his magic stone and never could, and that he would stop his magical claims, his claim to translate the Egyptian language, and the evidence that the Palmyra Revival was in 1824 and 5, not 1820. He seemed to be creating his own history for a supernatural persona. Now, psychobiography is speculative, but is cumulative in evidence, and better than a history that has no evidence, such as the Book of Mormon or Book of Abraham. Most writers who are the subjects of psychobiography have written fiction or nonfiction about people in history that have some basis of background in known history. But neither the Book of Mormon nor the Book of Abraham have any known basis in historical fact. They are creations of imagination and that allows the psychobiography to probe more deeply into the psyche of Joseph Smith. I also believe that his method of dictation had some similarities with the technique of psychoanalysis. Looking at blackness inside a hat is as factually empty as looking at the same ceiling tiles for months and years on end. Both methods allow for expansion of the eternal internal world of feeling and fantasy. Patients on the couch return to periods of conflict and despair, struggle with a painful issue for months, then leave it, maybe for months, and yet will return again and again over the years in treatment. I could expect the same from Joseph Smith, that he would return again and again to periods of conflict, despair, and fury, and that these issues would become the central issues in the Book of Mormon and repeat again and again. So what were the known issues? The known issues of physical and emotional pain and humiliation in his young life are 8 in number. First, he came from a dysfunctional and disreputable family, described by various people as lounging and idle, slovenly, an illiterate, whiskey-drinking, shiftless, irreligious race of people, and absent in respectability. Second, his horrendous leg surgery when probably he was 7 years old, he remembers being 5, followed by the painful and humiliating wagon trip to upstate New York when he was 11 and still limping. 6 years later would bring the death of his beloved brother by possible medical quackery. Then his humiliating court trial and imprisonment at the age of 20. The humiliating confrontation with his father-in-law who hated him. And then the stillborn death of his malformed, firstborn son, who he had told others would have supernatural abilities when born. And finally, his attempt to join his wife's church, perhaps in contrition, since the death of his stillborn death of his son, which led to direct confrontation and rejection by her church, but with the option of his repentance and public confession of his magical claims. He refused, and he was not allowed in their church. These painful incidents are behind the miraculous stories in the book and repeat again and again, reversed into fantasy and conquest. But it is the violence of blood and sword that characterize the book. I'll return to this point in a moment. Psychobiographers know that the first product by an author is usually the closest to autobiography and is extremely important. Who is Laban in the first story? Both Dr. Moraine and I realized that the story of Laban and his sword reflected his childhood leg surgery performed by the surgeon Nathan Smith, no connection to the Smith family. The sword was an important clue, but so also the family makeup. Change his older sister Sophronia into Sam, and change his next younger brother Samuel Harrison into Zoram, who joined the family and went to the New World with him, and then all 9 children, Smith children, are represented in the story. In psychobiography, we are interested in how he writes his real-life story, including what he doesn't tell us. Nowhere does he tell us about his 1826 trial, and his version given to Oliver Cowdery made it inconsequential. This is omission. And we are clued that what he omitted might be tremendously important. In this case, we have good reason to believe that it was. In this pretrial, he was found guilty of fraud and deception in claiming to be able to see underground and where buried treasure lay. He spent 1 night in jail, and a full trial was scheduled, but he was designedly allowed to leave because of his age, not yet 21, with the agreement he would leave town. In psychobiography, themes are important, and he presents his main theme in the first story of Laban and the Sword. I'm going to repeat this sentence twice because it is the sentence for this paper. He will reverse his helpless and inferior position, exaggerate, conquer and destroy those who cause him pain, and he will include miraculous supernatural abilities. He will reverse his helpless and inferior position, exaggerate, conquer and destroy those who cause him pain, and he will include miraculous supernatural abilities. There is an immediate confirmation of this theme in the migration part of the story. In real life, he was humiliated, in pain, still limping, knocked down in blood and mud, and treated contemptuously on the wagon trip to Palmyra while the wagon master flirted with the girls of another family on the trip. The migration story repeats in Book of Mormon fantasy on the boat to the Americas. Nephi is bound and beaten, and his joints are in pain, while others rudely dance, sing, and, quote, make merry, unquote. Then God intervenes, threatens the voyage with storms. They release Nephi, and he saves the trip because of his faithfulness and supernatural ability with the magic compass. Once we understand his technique of reversal of humiliation, failure, and pain, we can quickly interpret the meaning behind the story. For example, in his real life, we know his father-in-law hated him, and Isaac Hale wished that he and his daughter had died rather than her marrying Joseph, and so Joseph had to elope with Hale's daughter, Emma. In the Book of Mormon, this story is reversed. The heroic swordsman and missionary Ammon is brought before King Lamoni, who is favorably impressed with Ammon, wants to know if he will live with him, and then offers Ammon one of his daughters to wife. Ammon replies, "No, but I'll be thy servant." He then protects the king's flock by slingshot and sword, cuts off the arms of the thieves. He behaves heroically. His real-life father-in-law's hatred of him is reversed in fantasy, and he pleads with Ammon to marry his daughter. I reviewed the story of the United States occurring at the time Joseph Smith was dictating the Book of Mormon and ended up focusing on Andrew Jackson. Smith will repeat the election conflicts of 1824 and 1828 when the common folk believed that the king man, John Quincy Adams, was about to return us to a monarchy. But the world was saved in Book of Mormon fantasy by Moroni and his title of liberty raised against the evil Amalickiah seeking to be king. So similar to the hickory pole raised in astonishing numbers all over the United States, around the country, in support of Old Hickory, the nickname for Andrew Jackson. Smith will exaggerate and Christianize the topics of the day, and he had practiced at telling his stories so repeatedly over 4 years to his family that he could adapt them to the daily incidents that were occurring around him. We need to pay attention, special attention, to what he emphasizes. In general, the Book of Mormon is a book of terror, hatred, and destruction, filled with swords and fighting, and relentless wars that bring in the supernatural. It is the childhood surgical trauma that provides a central part of the relentless imagery of the violence in the book. Adults with this mental illness of post-traumatic stress disorder want the driving images to stop, for they cause distress, sometimes to the point of suicide. Lucy, his mother, describes Joseph telling his stories to the family nightly for years. Even allowing for exaggeration, Joseph still had the opportunity of hundreds of practice sessions that made it easy for him to adapt and insert happenings that were occurring around him. One example that you know was the story of Martin Harris taking the characters copied from the gold plates to Charles Anthon at Columbia University. Joseph worked this into a prophecy about a learned man who said he couldn't read a closed book, and you've all read it in 2 Nephi. With the family's acceptance of the stories as fact, the distress of the images became acceptable to him and less distressing. This is a general emphasis throughout the book, but there are times of specific emphasis that deserve our attention. The Book of Mormon is chronological in general. Year and decade periods are fairly easy to follow. But in the story of the crucifixion of Christ, he gives a specific date for the crucifixion, and I wondered how many times he makes this emphasis in the book. There are 8 times he gives not just a year or a month and a year, but also a specific day. And I felt challenged to see if I could discern at least some of the reasons for some of these dates a special emphasis. 3 of these dates have to do with the destruction of the city of Ammonia. Let us speculate about this story, using what we have learned from his other stories in the book, and then use what we learned from this story to understand a 4th specific date given for the crucifixion of Jesus. Around 82 BC, in chapter 8 of the book of Alma, Alma leaves Zarahemla to preach in the land of Melek, which is, quote, on the west of the riverside and on the west by the borders of the wilderness, end quote. Knowing how Joseph Smith had created his fantasies from the first stories in the Book of Mormon, we can suspect that he is telling us about leaving Palmyra in Manchester and traveling to near the river Susquehanna, called Sidon in the book, and we have a clue of both river names beginning with S. He comes to the wicked city of Ammonia, and like the town of South Bainbridge in real life, the site of his 1826 trial, the towns in the Book of Mormon were named after those who, quote, were first possessed of, a true fact concerning the towns around South Bainbridge. There are just a dozen of them named after the founder of the town. He is reviled and spit on and leaves the town, but an angel sends him back. One person, Amelia, receives him because of an angelic vision he experienced. This is the first specific date. On the fourth day of the seventh month in the 10th year of the reign of Judges, and invites him into his house to eat and recover. Together they go to preach and are cast into prison. Our speculation is enhanced, and we are in the town of South Bainbridge, where he spent one night in prison and went to a pretrial examination and had only one main supporter, Josiah Stoll, with whom he stayed for months. Alma and Amulek gain a few converts, including a lesser judge by the name of Zizra. The people bind Alma and Amulek, take them before the chief judge in the land. Their converts are thrown into the fire and killed, and they are struck and spit on, bound, put in prison, stripped naked, and starved for weeks. They were again struck by their teachers and liars, who challenged them to have their God save them. Finally, second specific day, on the 12th day in the 10th month in the 10th year of the reign of Judges, God does and brings an earthquake, demolishes the prison, releases Alma and Amulek, and kills all the wicked who have been demeaning them in prison. Then, third day, in the 11th year of the reign of Judges, on the 5th day of the 2nd month, there was a cry of war heard throughout the land. The Lamanites had arrived, and, quote, the people of Ammonia were destroyed, yea, every living soul was destroyed, and also their great city. And one day was left desolate, and the carcasses were mangled by dogs and wild beasts of the wilderness, and it was called Desolation. Once again, this is a story of reversal of humiliation and compensatory conquest. We are reminded of Joseph Smith's claim of supernatural magic, and Josiah Stoll's belief in him, that Joseph Smith was brought before Judge Albert Neely by Josiah Stoll's family, who were fearful of his giving his wealth to Smith, and that he spent one night in jail, was found guilty in this pretrial, humiliated and threatened with a full trial before a panel of judges, but instead was released because of his age and agreement he would leave town. But we are also warned not to humiliate Joseph Smith or put him in jail, for his fantasies include ultimate destruction of his enemies. Will this story then help us understand the specific date given for the crucifixion of Jesus? In the book of 3 Nephi, beginning in the third chapter and extending for the next 20 chapters in symbolic and indirect form, Joseph Smith reviews his life, touching on areas of pain and humiliation. He will begin with his childhood leg surgery, described as the greatest and bloodiest war of the Nephites had experienced in 600 years, and bloody details are given. He continues then and describes, as the Smith family experienced hunger, immigration from New England to upstate New York, the expansion of the United States under President James Monroe, and all this is discernible in the next chapters in 3 Nephi. The correlation in the Book of Mormon is that the government is on the verge of collapse. The prophet Nephi arrives in the year AD 31. Nephi first sees angels and then resurrects his brother, who had been stoned to death by the evil Nephites. This occurs near the end of AD 31. This should alert us, for we recall that the death of Alvin was one of the eight incidents of pain and humiliation in Joseph's life, And we are now remembered that Joseph Smith reported the first visit of the angel, Moroni or Nephi, take your pick, and that the brother's death happened just like the Nephi's brother shortly afterwards. The correlating date to AD 31 is therefore 1823, and Joseph is compensated for the death of his brother in the fantasy of the resurrection performed by Nephi. And in both the Book of Mormon and in Joseph's real life, the death of the brother is followed by the revival. The specific date for the crucifixion of Christ was, quote, in the 34th year of the first month on the fourth day of the month. This is about 27 months after the death of the brother. 27 months after November of 1823, when Alan died, it puts us into the spring of 1826, and we are back at a South Bainbridge trial in March of 1826. The real-life guilty verdict of Joseph Smith in the pretrial has become the fantasy guilty verdict of the Nephites, and Jesus acts as Joseph Smith's judge in destroying everyone in 16 cities and great cities, including women, pregnant mothers, children under 8 years of age, and babies. We learn once again that a South Bainbridge trial humiliated him and that Joseph Smith cannot tolerate humiliation well. His retaliation in fantasy is to kill almost everyone. We are forced to make some beginning and unattractive opinions about the morality of Joseph Smith. And some Mormons might wonder, is this the Jesus they want to worship? Conclusions. Smith knew what he was doing every step of the way. He suffered no mental illness as such. He twisted the violent images of a surgical trauma to his advantages in intentionally creating stories to convince others of his miraculous powers. And the stories in the Book of Mormon are largely compensatory for the 8 tragic episodes in his tragic life. His personality was the result of 3 factors. First, he was a child in a dysfunctional family, characterized by poverty, alcoholism in the father, delusional beliefs and practice in the world of ceremonial magic, folk magic, and training in deception of self and others. The model of his dysfunctional family became the outline of his conscience. In addition, I believe he experienced childhood post-traumatic stress disorder, and his fantasies were probably driven by this experience. But by the time he was an adult, the violent fantasies still continued, but he had reversed them from alien and disturbing to him, and instead he unified with the fantasies and used them in the goals to deceive others and magnify himself. Thirdly, he was the result of his followers. Non-believing Mormon historian Dale Morgan wrote, "The responsibility of his followers is not to be dismissed in the make of their prophet. Their hunger for miracle, their thirst for the marvelous, their lust for assurance that they were God's chosen people to be preserved on the great and terrible day make them hardly less than Joseph, the authors of his history." His personality failure was not the product of a specific illness such as manic depressive illness or schizophrenia. His disorder was of a general personality, character disturbance, and there are 2 possibilities: the narcissistic personality and the antisocial or psychopathic personality. Quote, "Vulnerability and self-esteem makes individuals with narcissistic personality very sensitive to injury from criticism or defeat. In addition, the narcissistic personality diagnosis consists of a pervasive pattern of grandiosity and need for admiration." With Smith's claim to magical and then Christian miracles to win people to believe in him and gain power over them, he qualifies for the diagnosis and demonstrates all characteristics. Now, in addition, comparison or contrast. The diagnosis of antisocial personality, that is what is usually called psychopathic personality, consists of a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest. Deceitfulness, as indicated by lying, use of aliases, or conning others for personal profit or pleasure, and lack of remorse. These are official diagnoses from the Standard Sourcebook for Classification of Mental Disorders. Smith qualifies for both diagnoses, and then the unofficial term is malignant narcissism, somewhere on a sliding scale between the two. Now, perhaps there was a time earlier when his path of deceit could have been reversed. And the testimony of Peter Ingersoll, who witnessed the confrontation between Joseph Smith and his father-in-law, suggests this possibility. But the path of supernatural claims was reinforced by his family and later others. This artificial, superimposed self became who he was, not only to others, but to himself. Over time, his followers had an important hand in cementing his personality as a prophet of God with unlimited power over them. And then nothing would have reversed it.
Do you understand me? Is that good enough? Okay. I hope you understand me. As I have previously acknowledged, I am not a psychiatrist. I just play one in Mormon Studies Symposium. But I am a surgeon, and I'm aware that some have extolled my field as a splendid fusion of art and science, of hand and mind, and of right and left brains. And I can testify that today's surgical operations will usually be both therapeutic and relatively comfortable because of a triad of anesthesia, antisepsis, and analgesia. But in truth, these moderating factors serve merely as disguises to obscure a hidden reality, that a surgical operation is at its core a violent act performed by one person upon another. Only when those diagnoses fail does this true reality shatter through, as was invariably the case in centuries past. And while an adult may interpret a painful surgical misfortune in terms suggesting an assault, a child will not. For in the mind of a small child, pain deliberately inflicted by an adult male can register only as punishment. For that is the only data that has ever been entered into the young cerebral software. And that's where the why comes in for the bewildered child, as he or she desperately struggles to come to terms with the horror of a painful surgical adventure when that triad of diagnoses, of disguises, is not present. And that why, for one particular surgical victim, is ultimately why we come back to meetings like this year after year. This is a scalpel that a surgeon wields today. But this is its 19th century counterpart, equivalent, an amputation knife identical to that which Dr. Nathan Smith brandished over the fetid, infected left leg of fully conscious 7-year-old Joseph Smith Jr. 2 centuries ago. As his mother fled the room, the father abetted a handful of medical students in restraining the surely bound and spread-eagle boy as Dr. Smith slashed, sawed, pried, and wrenched out chunks of dead tibial bone, the blood splashing over them all and onto the bedclothes and floor. And in the critical aftermath, when he needed the reassuring comfort of his parents the most, they would instead send him away to recuperate at his uncle's seaside home. Indeed, wartime combatants and injured adults often suffer equivalent pain from traumatic injuries and may go on to develop classic post-traumatic stress disorders if overwhelming emotional stress accompanies the event. This adult form of PTSD is not unlike the surreptitious entry of a virus into the software, wherein an external trigger relating to the event can set off a terrifying flashback with predictable temporary symptoms. but when a small child experiences such a horrible physical and emotional trauma, the result is very different. Instead of the introduction of a sporadic viral intruder, the event effectively reboots the developing brain and reinstalls the entire system software, with the trauma becoming an integral part of the psyche that can permeate all corners of the mind forever. Dr. Anderson and I agree that this was the case with Joseph Smith. It is doubtful that the event was responsible for his narcissism, since that diagnosis is believed to spring from the earliest childhood years in the pre-Oedipal period. But Joseph's efforts to come to terms with his awful trauma gave the narcissism its charismatic voice through the unique and colorful eruption of imagination and metaphor that flowed out of that awful event. Dr. Lenore Terre, the child psychiatrist whose pioneering studies have revolutionized our understanding of childhood trauma, has written, quote, "A whole life can be shaped by an old trauma, remembered or not," end quote. She emphasizes that traumatized children act out their troubles in many ways, including dreams, play, reenactments, and brightly colored visualizations, all carrying recognizable elements of the original event. In addition, such children characteristically believe they are psychic and have paranormal gifts of clairvoyance. For some reason, surrounding playmates and later adults seem to be magnetically attracted to the games that the traumatized child creates. One remembers, for example, the elaborate moonlit money-digging rituals that Joseph led, including the one in which, quote, "A messenger was then sent to Palmyra to procure a polished sword, after which Samuel F. Lawrence, with a drawn sword in his hand, marched around to guard any assault which his satanic majesty might be disposed to make," end quote. One can easily follow the direct progression from these little pageants to Joseph's temple rituals, in which initiates are washed, clean from the blood and sins of this generation, their arms instructed to be strong to wield the sword, their attention drawn to a sword waving through the curtain, and a pure white garment applied, one which had at the beginning been trimmed in turkey red. And in the original ritual, the officiant slashed the garment across both knees so deeply that it drew blood and left a scar. Such were Joseph's thinly disguised games and reenactments of his operations. I will have more to say later about dream content, but it is worth recalling Joseph's final dream the night before his murder. In this dream, he was in an old barn when a group of men rushed in, brandishing knives and threatening him with the destruction of his body. He struggled to get out of the barn, but was up to his ankles in deep mud so that his immobilized legs could not run. Remembering the aftermath of Joseph's surgery, it is notable that the initial storyline of both sections of his magnum opus was about families who encounter chaos in their lives, which they resolve by traveling down to the seashore. In addition, one of Joseph's favorite metaphors was that of blood on garments, his own representation of sin, with the accompanying need to expunge the evil blood to restore whiteness in an act of atonement. And it is also worth remembering that the very first ritual that Joseph introduced was that of foot washing. Of course, this act of obeisance dates from the antiquity of the arid Middle East and Levant, where soothing relief from the hot sand was a great comfort. But in the long history of foot washing rituals, there was never a reference in metaphor to washing away blood until Joseph introduced it in the mid-19th century. And finally, there is Joseph's recurring dream of the angel with the drawn sword that appears over and over as his personal justification for the institution of polygamy. It is axiomatic in psychiatry that recurring dreams, unlike sporadic ones, always have a referent in real life. As those of us who know who must periodically face the nighttime terror of a college examination for which we are unprepared. In Joseph's case, the angel in the recurring dream invariably demanded that he take some woman to wife, lest some feature of his potency be taken away. Now, while this seems paradoxically puzzling at first, it fits perfectly with the diagnosis of a defensive counterphobic reaction, if one assumes that the original operation occurred during Joseph's Oedipal phase of development with its age-specific fantasy of eroticism toward mother. Thus, whereas he was originally punished for experiencing eroticism, he is in his recurring dream now threatened with punishment if he avoids it. For Joseph Smith, eroticism would forever be linked with the threat of violence. It is as though he is living out a compulsion to conquer that threat by insatiably seeking out the feared eroticism, if only he can relive it often enough that it will no longer be fearful. Since Dr. Anderson and I agree that Joseph Smith's autobiographical references to the childhood surgery appear frequently in his writings, I wish to highlight two in particular, one each from the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham. The first occurs at the very outset of the Book of Mormon, where righteous father Lehi instructs his young heroic son Nephi to return to Jerusalem from the seashore with his brothers to obtain important records. The records are in the hands of the quintessentially evil Laban, whose only virtue appears to be his possession of a wondrous sword of exceedingly fine workmanship with a hilt of pure gold and a blade of the most precious steel. After the brothers are cruelly rebuffed by Laban in their request, Nephi returns alone at night to find his nemesis lying drunk in the street. Nephi unsheaths the sword from Laban's scabbard and decapitates him with it. He then puts on Laban's clothes and girds the sword about his own loins to trick the guardian of the records into releasing them so that he may return triumphantly to his father at the seashore. In this vignette, Joseph Smith, portraying himself as the hero, acts out his dream of revenge against his surgeon in a classic overthrow event. In truth, the act is against a fused surgeon-father image, since Joseph Sr. had been a willing accomplice in the painful operation by helping to restrain his son. As is typical of the wishful daydreams of such victims, Joseph reverses the original roles as he himself now brandishes the knife and dismembers his original assailant. The fact that the event occurs at night suggests that the deed was not a noble one, and Laban's comatose state assures that the hero will not have to look him in the eye. By Nephi's disguise in wearing Laban's clothes and sword, Joseph demonstrates his identification with the evil one through his act of cold-blooded murder. Now, there are many layers to this story, one of which is Joseph's use of the psychological defense of splitting, wherein he has divided father into two divergent personages, righteous Lehi and evil Laban, a reflection of the ambivalence that typifies the Oedipal stage of development. But while father must not be destroyed, if the odious part may be split off, that half is fair game, so that the beloved half may be permitted to endure. Laban's sword, of course, represents Dr. Nathan Smith's amputation knife, the fearsome instrument of Joseph's childhood pain. As the iconic symbol of his operation, the sword will thus become reborn as the chief talisman of the Book of Mormon, reappearing often through the narrative as a symbol of invincible great strength, and later reappearing in the alleged box of gold plates in upstate New York. An admirer would later report Joseph even to be carrying it himself in triumphant battle against his Missouri enemies. Transformed from the amputation knife into the Book of Mormon's talisman, the imagery of the sword would come to symbolize absolute power as it permeated Joseph's speeches and writings throughout his life. As a final note, the setting of the Laban story in the Book of Mormon is critical to its fullest understanding, for it occurs not in the promise of the New World, but in the unresolved disarray of the Old. Nephi must leave the safe harbor of the seashore and return to the site of inland chaos to settle an old score before life can go on. The parallelism to Joseph's convalescent exile at his uncle's seaside home transparently suggests that it was there that this narrative began to fester in the wounded corners of his newly traumatized mind. The child that returned from the seashore would forever be a very different Joseph Smith than the one who had sensed a bit of soreness in his left leg a few weeks before. The second autobiographical reference to Joseph's surgery is largely a pictorial one. Okay, let's wiggle this and make it work. Help. Is largely a pictorial one. End of slideshow.
Hit the arrow up button 5, 6, or 7 times.
Can we can we go to one?
Yep.
We can.
I just don't want to give it all away.
All right.
Is largely a pictorial one.
Uh-oh.
Can you cut the lights shining on the screen?
No, it's
maybe the keyboard.
Are you hitting an enter still?
What's that?
Yeah.
Ah, there we go. I'll just use the enter button.
Okay.
It arose out of an ancient Egyptian papyrus that was purchased by Joseph's followers in Kirtland, Ohio, after he had announced the ability to translate its hieroglyphics. One particular picture on the scroll caught Joseph's eye, a portion of a typical funerary document. In the center of the original picture, in the center of the original picture had been a supine figure representing Osiris with his right hand held over his face in a sign of grief. This is not going to work for them. Okay. Osiris' left hand had held his phallus to impregnate his wife Isis, depicted as a hovering falcon. Above Osiris' head had been a human-headed bird representing the soul awaiting entrance to his body, and standing over Osiris' legs was the jackal-headed god Anubis preparing to embalm him. But not all of the picture remained when Joseph encountered it, because marginal portions of the papyrus had fragmented off in handling. The missing pieces included the jackal's head and outstretched arm, Osiris' trunk, phallus and left upper extremity, and all of falcon wife Isis except the tip of 1/7 feathered wing. When the original unrolled papyrus was rediscovered in 1966, it was found to have been glued onto stiff backing very early, and some crude sketches had been added. A man's head now replaced the jackal's, and a raised right hand was brandishing a knife in a threatening posture. Instead of the falcon, the remaining feathers had become Osiris' extended left hand. The supine figure now evinced a defensive posture, attempting to ward off a bodily attack. There could be little doubt who had done the sketching, not only for the content of the additions, but for who could have possessed the authority to disfigure a document that had been prophetically declared sacred. Joseph would later sit with local artist Reuben Headlock, giving precise instructions to reproduce the illustration in a woodcut format to be published in Times and Seasons on March 1, 1842, with numbers added for clarification. Those numbers identified Osiris as Abraham, the Caucasian-headed former jackal, as an idolatrous priest with a large knife in his outstretched hand poised to offer up Abraham as a sacrifice, and the human-headed bird as the angel of the Lord, ready to rescue Abraham from his fate. Now concentrate on the body language. The assailant with his threatening blade is positioned over his victim's legs as the prostrate figure helplessly holds up his arms in mortal defense of his body. Is this a scriptural depiction of an attack against the Hebraic patriarch, or is it the tortured memory of a 7-year-old boy screaming in desperation against the impending cruelty of a heartless surgeon? For Joseph Smith Jr., the horror of an awful event yet remained a haunting presence even after 3 decades. Dr. Lenore Terre's observation was correct. A whole life can be shaped by an old trauma, remembered or not. There can be no question that the Book of Mormon teems with the themes of his childhood operations as well. But after reading 713 pages of mercilessly repetitive prose, I was at once astounded to encounter a brand new character in the book. Neither the typical diminutive but righteous young hero, nor an evil king, not even a rare woman. The young hero was there all right, but was for the first time subordinated in rapturous awe to his superhero brother, who, like Yahweh, was too exalted even to have his name voiced. This brother talked to God, interceded for the young hero, saw Jesus Christ in the flesh millennia before his birth, and viewed the future of all humanity. He would also receive two seer stones and ecclesiastical instructions to write a historical record to be passed to the Gentiles through a prophet in the latter days. Brother of Jared certainly had to represent someone very important to Joseph Smith, and it took little time to resolve this mystery. Alvin Smith was the firstborn of Joseph Sr. and Lucy. Available descriptions of him suggest that he was his parents' favorite, the one with the special gifts, and also a seer and treasure seeker. Joseph Jr. evidently worshipped his big brother as well, describing him as, quote, one of the noblest sons of men. He lived without spot from the time he was a child, end quote. But the feature that most exalted Alvin for Joseph Jr. was undoubtedly his untimely death in the family home at age 25, most likely from an appendiceal rupture. Joseph was 17 at the time. My reflections on this incident suggested that the Book of Ether, rather than a mere paean to Alvin, carried a much deeper message. It was clear from the text that brother was older than the Joseph Smith Jared character. Brother acted as righteous leader of the family through the escape from the old world to the new, but when it came time to pass the leadership to a new generation, the transfer was not to brother's own offspring, but instead to Jared's youngest son. Both through this succession of the mantle of leadership and through the foreshadowed transfer of the seer stones, Joseph Smith has clearly described his usurpation of Alvin's firstborn position in the Smith family. This passage of the torch is the hidden message of the Book of Ether. And the importance of this message is exemplified by the fact that it occupies the full opening 12 pages of the book, relegating the subsequent rise and fall of the entire Jaredite civilization to just 23 more. In searching the psychiatric literature for reactions to sibling death, I found the most comprehensive clinical work to be that of a University of Michigan researcher aptly named Cain, that's C-A-I-N, Cain, on sibling death. His work described the principal and near universal reaction of surviving siblings to be that of overwhelming guilt for in some way having caused or having failed to prevent the sibling's death, regardless of whether there was any rational basis for this emotion whatever. Assuming then that this applied to Joseph, I began to look for possible pieces in Joseph's personal story that might support this suggestion, and was hardly disappointed. I have long assumed, for instance, that the so-called coming forth of the Book of Mormon saga of annual visits to Hill Cumorah was a most unlikely bit of storytelling, but could not understand why it was such an unusual one. Typical treasure-seeking stories, like that of Aladdin and his lamp, carry the identical theme of a clever boy needing to discover some secret, usually sexually symbolic, in order to outwit the evil father representation that possesses the treasure. But why five annual visits on September 22 each year from 1823 to 1827 with repeated punishing rejections by the treasure guardian until the secret could be found? Why not just march up the hill and claim the treasure at once or in a brief series of encounters? Something important was missing. To review the details of this doubtful annual sequence, Joseph first is forbidden to take the treasure in 1823, but it's advised that if he brings his oldest brother the following year, he will be rewarded. But since Alvin will die 2 months hence, the 1824 visit is unsuccessful, and some form of Alvin's substitute must be provided the following September 22. Joseph cannot do so on each annual occasion until 1827, when a fitting Alvin substitute, his new wife Emma, becomes the sexually symbolic key to the quest, and the treasure is obtained. She immediately becomes pregnant. Notably, Joseph goes on to tell his father-in-law and others that the first person to see his newfound gold plates would be a young child, and Emma delivers their baby boy on schedule. Unfortunately, this infant, promptly named Alvin, is terribly deformed and expires within 3 hours. Seemingly, Joseph has made his deceased oldest brother the central figure, a veritable talisman in the treasure quest. To assist in understanding why, it is worth noting that the historical record shows no evidence that any of Joseph's cohorts in his nefarious money-digging schemes over those 4 years knew anything at all about those alleged visits to the hill until shortly before the final 1827 event itself. In addition, the family members' later recollections merely parroted back conflicting parts of Joseph's own fabrications for the first four visits, suggesting a hypothesis that the whole idea of the gold plates originated only in 1827, none of the previous annual visits to the hill ever having occurred at all. If so, there is a tantalizing clue to understanding this quandary that lies in an obscure historical sequel to Alvin's death. It seems that Joseph Smith Sr. went out to the gravesite with some neighbors on September 25, 1824, and dug up his firstborn's corpse. It is not known if Joseph Jr. was along, but the sight of the unembalmed 10-month-old carcass would have been hideous to any who remembered the youthful brother in his prime. One can only imagine the unnecessary recrudescence of grief and accompanying emotions that the exhumation would have stirred. The date of Alvin's exhumation was the fourth Saturday in September 1824. The date of Joseph's acquisition of his treasure in 1827 was also the fourth Saturday in September, when by now Joseph had reached his 25th year and become Alvin's chronological equal. Thus, these doubtful visits in Joseph's imaginary world backdated to a point prior to the exhumation in order to include Alvin in the story are consistent with what psychiatrists term an anniversary reaction, often seen clinically in cases of victims of stressful rapes, family deaths, accidents, and the like. Thus, Joseph's post-traumatic personality seems not to have created a marvelous work and a wonder, so much as a marvelous myth of memorial to deal with the grief and guilt of his assumption of Alvin's mantle. And the content of that myth, digging up a box whose priceless and longed-for treasure evokes punishment for attempting to bring it home, is probably not unlike Joseph's own ruminations over his brother's exhumation, the only time the family shovel work ever found what it was digging for. Joseph would go on to fuse his identity with Alvin's in the creation of the consummate literary hero of his novel by bracketing the last three letters of his own name with the last two of Alvin's, in the invention of the name Nephi, thereby assuaging a portion of his guilt over his brother's tragic death. And he would inscribe on the inside cover of Manuscript History of the Church, Book A1, his personal notation, quote, "In the memory of Alvin Smith, died the 19th day of November, in the 25th year of his age, 1823. And one final holographic source graphically suggests the centrality of Alvin in Joseph's mythological narrative. The characters of supposed reformed Egyptian that Joseph scribbled for Martin Harris to take to the learned are especially revealing on close inspection of four loci. It has already been described that he inserted cryptic references to himself in two locations as J-O-S and J-O-E. A bit of sleuthing also discloses matching references to his lost brother in a couple more, once read forward as A-L-V, and another in reverse order, A-L-V. At least he had a cryptic sense of humor. There is also some reason to suspect that Joseph's paranormal experiences might be related to Alvin as well. So-called theophanies are generally regarded in psychiatry as representing images of the father. But in Joseph's most noted description of his first vision, there is not a single image, but rather two. and they are related as father and son. In the apparition, the father identifies and empowers the son, hear him, and the son himself passes the torch by relaying the instructions to Joseph. In the second vision, it is a personage who conveys the message, and Joseph does not act on the instructions until Joseph Sr. verifies the next day that he should do so, again confirming the father to older brother sequence of rank and stature. The two paranormal experiences in the first and second vision are identical in this respect. In this light, Alvin may again be seen as passing the family torch to Joseph Jr., the same message as in the Book of Ether. Notably, Joseph describes his apparitions in exceeding detail. Loose robe of exquisite whiteness, beyond any earthly thing I had ever seen. Also were his feet naked, as were his legs a little above the ankles, end quote. In her writings of traumatized children, Dr. Lenore Terre makes the poignant observation, quote, saintly visions, as recorded by the church, include the precision of detail and the vivid colorations that you also see in the visual experiences of traumatized kids. Yes, perhaps the saints were traumatized, at least some of them, end quote, she adds. With this quote in mind, one is tempted to ask whether it is Smith or Terre who is the superior prophet. And finally, we have Joseph's final sacrament, introduced suddenly in the fall of 1840 when his father was on his deathbed. Joseph announced at this time that members of his church could be baptized for dead relatives, quote, whom they believe would have embraced the gospel if they had been privileged with hearing it, end quote. Joseph Sr. would die in mid-September, already a troubled season of mourning for Joseph Jr. It is noteworthy that psychiatrist Eric Lindemann's studies of family deaths have demonstrated that the most striking and most frequent feature of grief responses over those who have died suddenly is that of delay or postponement. Lindemann noted many cases in which a rather severe grief reaction was not for the one who had just died, but rather because it brought out the unresolved grief for a loved one who had died long before. This would help to explain why Joseph's father's impending death brought forth this ritual, de novo, and why Joseph returned to sermonizing on it time and again in subsequent Septembers. Despite his admiration for notable historic figures, Joseph restricted the rite of baptism for the dead exclusively to relatives, evidently because it was a particular relative whose need for baptism Joseph felt so acutely. Having usurped Alvin's position as firstborn in the Smith family before Joseph had established his new church, he had to do something to make it all right. But by sharing the privilege with his followers, Joseph had created the critical need to find out just who all those unbaptized souls were. Inside Granite Mountain and on many terabytes of computer memory are today listed the names of billions of the deceased, intertwining Latter-day Saints into extended families back through the generations. It is Joseph's final and most lasting tribute to the troubling memory of his lost brother. The Mormon tradition did not arise from the serenity of a grove. It grew out of the anguished suffering of its founder, a violent assault at age 7 compounded by an agonizing loss at 17. The first contorted his mind's development, and the second spawned dazzling new themes into his world of imagination. The combination proved far greater than the sum of its parts, for neither alone would have resulted in our being here today. Finally, there can be little doubt that the prophet puzzle is still missing a few lost pieces. But I would hope that Dr. Anderson and I might have discovered two or three that have been locked away in unexplored corners for a long time. Thank you. Mr. Place.
I'm going to turn this over to question and answer for our two distinguished presenters. Questions? Oh, Michael.
So, I'm not sure how to frame this, but it's more a question about the methodology of the approach. And I recognize that I come out of, you know, my own figure discipline, and it's methodologies which are inherent biases that we all have. So I guess in my post-enlightenment rush towards positivism, when I look for data and evidence at that level, how does this approach psychobiography respond to the questions of, well, how do we know you're not just pulling spurious events and making connections that are going to randomly happen throughout a 39-year lifespan in any event?
Well, when your only tool is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail, Mike. You know? I'll let him answer that.
It's a correct concern to consider what you're up against, and that is, we argue that all psychobiography is speculative and cumulative, and the stories in the Book of Mormon, the theme which I gave and stated twice, is the theme throughout the Book of Mormon, and then you look for cumulative evidence for that. It remains always speculative, but what is your option? You're going to tell me that the Book of Mormon narrative is factual history of pre-Columbia America? In the words of Kerry Murphy, there is no archaeological, anthropological, ethnological, morphological, linguistic evidence of that at all, and now you're countered by the whole DNA evidence of all.
Other questions?
I just have a question about identifying Joseph Smith as being a narcissist. I am now under attack by an evil stepson who's a narcissist, and it turns out he's been attacking me, about my knowledge, for 30 years. So I understand this diagnosis, and per se, there's no legal thing about being a narcissist. Can't be legally examined to be judged. And so in retrospect, how do you actually draw this conclusion? Because it's a very iffy prognosis, diagnosis.
The criteria are well established and laid out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in the DSM-4.
8, 9 points.
Mm-hmm. 9 points, okay. And they are laid out, and one simply has to ask empirically, does Joseph Smith show any of these? And the conclusion?
He needs at least 5 of the 9 to make the diagnosis, and they include self-centeredness, feelings that he has superpowers, that he has super rights, and that he can manipulate other people. Those kind of things contribute to the diagnosis.
You must, of course, if he was who he said he was, he is all of those things under the direction of the superpowers, okay? But the fact is that he does satisfy all of those criteria, regardless of whether he is under the direction of above or within.
Brent?
It's interesting to note, too, that, for example, I believe it's ANC 137, which you alluded to, Bill, where in his vision of the celestial kingdom, Joseph specifically mentions that he sees Alvin there, but then calls out Alvin and says that he marveled at, you know, how could Alvin be there when he died before hearing the gospel, and that's when he's told that that those who would have accepted it had they lived will be heirs to the celestial kingdom. But what's intriguing about that, that's 1836, so when baptism for the dead comes along, we actually get a practice that seems to contradict what was given in the Revelation in 1836, because there's no need for baptism, right? It's the model that if they would have accepted it, had they been given the opportunity, they'll be heirs of the celestial kingdom. But it seems like, I don't know, it almost strengthens to me your point that the death of, or the dying senior Smith is having a real impact on him at that point, and now the issue of the baptism again, harking back, of course, to what the minister tells Joseph's parents and about Alvin when he dies, that he says that he's going to hell because he was never baptized. So now, by the time we get down to the 1840 time period, the actual institution of baptism for the dead is becoming a reality.
Yeah, I think that the answer to that is that he, it still troubled him. He may have had that vision that he's there in heaven with the two saints and so forth, but he's using belt and suspenders here to hold up these pants. I mean, he's got to get every possible thing in there to make sure. It, just because he sees him there doesn't take away the anxiety and the guilt he had over whatever.
Yeah, and that's why I think that your suggestion that, again, seeing his father right now has kind of brought it all back up again, all over. That's interesting.
I have an interesting thought, and that is that the close connection in the death of Alvin to the angel Moroni and the description of the angel Moroni and his white garments, the verbalism, how far the white shroud went down on the body of Nephi or Moroni, take your pick. And that is, was this a memory of how they wrapped his brother for the grave?
You can speculate all kinds of pieces, additional pieces to this puzzle. And when we go too far, who knows? It's all we're looking at is shadows. But the patterns. Shadows are consistent.
Patterns,
yeah. As who was it who said history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes? And this is what we're looking at.
Jenny?
I have an insight into the baptism question. Because that's actually, this is an interesting parallel that I share with Joseph Smith, is this grief, a teenage grief compounded by another death of a family and a religious pursuit to make sense of that. And I've wondered the same thing, why is baptism necessary for the dead? And the best explanation I can come up with is it's something that we as people can do, it's a ritual to help us feel good. And I do believe, a part of me wants to believe that it's not necessary, that they're not dependent upon us as humans to do an act, but that it helps us, it helps communities.
But he put in a caveat. It isn't for everybody. It's only for your relatives. And that's the piece that I think ties it to Alvin. The fact that you could then go and find out who all these other relatives are is the icing on the cake, but it's not the cake. The cake was a relative, and that's what he did it for, and it fits. Now, whether or not it's the fact, we don't know, but it fits the theory.
Mm-hmm. Levi?
Well, from your view, had the Book of Mormon been written, even if the surgery hadn't happened? So you make a good deal out of the trauma of the surgery. Say that hadn't happened, but all the everything else in the family remains the same as the Book of Mormon. How important is the trauma to the production of the Book of Mormon?
He has the typical post-traumatic child disorder, the one that I described, where you reboot the brain and then you've got all of, if you read Lenore Terra's work, she has one child situation after another. She studied those who were, if anyone is old enough to remember the Chowchilla situation where somebody stole a school bus full of kids and buried it, she studied all of those kids. She studied the kids who watched the Challenger disaster when the satellite or the rocket blew up. And she studied all of those kids, and they just, to a person, were showing this. They all played the games. They all had reactions to it, which fit this pattern. And he is a storyteller. He's a yarn spinner. And it started shortly after the way his mother describes that. She says, I think I can quote it closely, he tells the story about the previous inhabitants, their wars, their mode of dress, their everything, as though he had lived with them his entire life. I think he had only lived with them since the age of 7. But it was that personality tied into whatever caused the narcissism in the first place that made this personality that plays the games that are related to it, that tells the stories that are related to it, and that everybody is just magnetized to this personality. It played a significant role. I can't answer the question, would he have written the Book of Mormon otherwise?
Okay.
What we do know is that he had been trained by his father, and the whole family was supporting the idea of a shift into magic, taking advantage of other people and tricking them into a belief that he could dig in the ground and find buried treasure. And it was fraud. And he was found guilty in the pretrial, humiliated by it all. His father-in-law confronts him, but the goal had been he was going to be a magician, tricking people, deceiving people, and for whatever gain he could get. Whether he would have turned to a gold book, I mean, prior to the gold book, he was after gold things, gold watches, everything else, anything gold found in the thing, trying to find the gold, the silver mine for Josiah Stoll, for example. So he was on the track of deceiving people, trained by his father, trained in the family for that. Then whether something stirred for him to write a book, I don't know.
I personally think that he might well have written a book, but I don't think it would have had the degree of religious overtone had he not suffered the bereavement episode involving his brother. Because I think it was his brother that he saw in his visions. It was that's the one where Lenore Terre says, if you get trauma and bereavement at the same time, you can count on some really strange stuff happening. As a matter of fact, it was something like 60% of the high school age children who watched the Challenger disaster actually had some form of paranormal experience, some kind of extraordinarily vivid dream or voices or something like that. Bereavement trauma is really big stuff, and I think that's one of the major pieces, besides sitting in on all of those revival meetings, that gave it the religious overtone that has today. That's why I think both traumas were necessary for Joseph to have produced what he did.
And finally, there was his trial, 1826. There was a revival that exploded at the very end of 1824 and converted 15% of the people living in Palmyra through 1825. All of that revival information is the thick Christian layer throughout the whole Book of Mormon. But it is the 1826 trial that convinced him that he continued trying to convince people of his magic claims, of finding treasure buried in the ground, and that he can see great distances, he was going to end up in prison. That's when he shifted to Christian miracles instead of magic ones.
Lots of questions out there. Before we go to those, I have a whole bunch of questions, and I want to take those next, but I want to ask two quick ones in relationship to Alvin and the narcissistic wounding. You mentioned that he was narcissistically wounded or had some narcissism before the surgery. I'm curious what you speculate might be the causes or sources of that narcissistic wounding. And along with that, the notion of the family savior. You're looking at the psychological framework and also family relations frameworks, which are two of the most important ones, I think, for evaluating Joseph. So in family relations, I loved your work on Alvin, of course, and do you think that part of it is also the son who was lost? Because Joseph has to take his place, there's also a family relations and an economic. Who's going to save the family given the poverty? Is the economic aspect of sort of Joseph becoming the savior of the family, is that part of that too? Well, and then we'll take yours.
You've said that part very well. I can't add anything. Where does narcissism come from, Doctor?
I have a theory.
From shortly after birth, they thank God. It's a dysfunctional family, dysfunctional relationship with the mother. And this family was dysfunctional and disreputable and erratic. I mean, when they moved 12 times, fleeing creditors, coming after them, pay your bills, and going from poverty to some rented cabin to something else over a 10-year period. And the disruption of that, you know.
Just a very interesting sidelight. One would think that it was Hiram who would have taken it over. There may have been this rivalry piece, but it's shortly after Hiram is married that Joseph goes and grabs that woman and elopes with her so that he can keep up.
And along with that, I was fascinated by your attribution of the women in his life being connected to the relationship to the mother and also the violence and the connection with violence and sexualization. And I was curious if there's more to that. Is there also an issue of attachment disorder and abandonment syndrome that could be?
Well, don't get me started on Joseph Smith and women. You know,
sorry.
The Book of Mormon is grossly sexist. I mean, grossly. There are three women mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Three. Sariah, the mother, okay, and let's see, and what we're after is Alma's son, Corianton, who has the affair with the harlot Isabel. Who's the second one? Who's the third one?
Abish.
Okay. And, you know, the question is, who does Corianton, who's the third one again? Not Abish, but Isabel. Who does Isabel represent? And then we have one possible woman, Eliza Winters, that might have been the source of the story of Corianton and the harlot Isabel. And that remains unclear, but it's a fascinating story. And that is, we have the secondhand quote from Martin Harris that he didn't blame Joseph Smith for attempting to seduce Eliza Winters. And that's about all that we have. Later, Martin Harris was giving speeches, conversion speeches, missionary work, and he recognized Eliza in a group of people. He publicly, loudly denounced her as a harlot and referred to her as having had an illegitimate bastard child. And we don't know anything more about that. She sued him, but lost the lawsuit. Mm. I mean, you know, so we want to know everything we can about Eliza Winter.
More questions. Natalie and then Sol.
I have two questions. One quick, so I just want to clarify, you said that Joseph was out tricking people, trying to get them to give him money to find magic. So do you think that this is all, like both of you, do you think it's all a deception, or do you think that Joseph believed it? Like, is he delusional, or is he deceptive? Just curious which take.
You have a confrontation between Joseph Smith and his father-in-law. They eloped, they returned to Manchester, Palmyra, where they remained, and then Emma writes back to her father and says, can I get my possessions, furniture, cows, some other things? And the father says, come back. You're welcome to. Peter Ingersoll, the neighbor of Joseph Smith, who had a wagon, gets hired by Joseph Smith with his wagon to go back, and then you have an eyewitness of the first confrontation between Joseph and his new father-in-law. And his father-in-law weeps and says, I would rather have died and gone to the grave with my daughter than have her marry you. You deceive people. You try saying you can find gold underneath. And then Joseph Smith says, I can't. I never could. I will stop it. And the father-in-law says, I will help you get into standard good business if you will stay with me. And then Peter Ingersoll talks about the wagon trip back to Palmyra, in which he says, Joseph Smith said, this is going to be hard for me. And Peter Ingersoll said he seemed confused, because he says, we get back to Palmyra, they're going to want me to dig for gold and treasure. What am I going to do? And you know the answer.
I had more trouble criticizing Joseph in my book. I could never resolve that issue. Was it just that he was so convinced of his own position that he can be excused for that? And that's sort of the position. I never fully resolved it in my book. But the more I'm working with Bob, I can't hold on to that any longer. I think he was very deceptive.
More questions? Jenny, well, let's see. Let's have someone who hasn't, then we'll come back to you.
Right. Do you feel like commenting on the guy from Three Cups of Tea? Did anyone read the book, Three Cups of Tea?
What was the premise?
It's that wonderful book. He goes,
Afghanistan.
And he begins farming. Goes to Nepal and he begins farming schools for girls, brings in tons and tons of money, and then recently there was the confrontation. He hadn't done any of it, wasn't doing any of it.
He takes a story and he kind of spins it really well, and he wrote them as biographies.
And he Paul dumbed it.
So your question.
Paul dumbed it.
So your question is that so you're asking if
anyone wants to make me connection,
well, if you would compare that to
something similar.
Has anybody here not done that?
the difference.
He without sin.
The major difference is we haven't developed a following that encouraged us to be deceptive. That's the third factor in his creation. And what's his name who did the three cups of teas? He got a lot of following. Everybody rushed in to be assistive to him. And their story about him helps create his image of himself as doing this, doing this. And Joseph Smith was a creation of his followers. That's one of the three factors I list for his creation.
Other questions? Jenny, and then we have, go ahead.
What is the percentage, just give me an estimate if you know, of children who have experienced traumatic events and who have been traumatized and experienced this trauma syndrome?
I don't know if there are statistics on this. I know that Lenore Terre has maintained very thorough records longitudinally of at least those two episodes, the Chowchilla bus and the Challenger. I have not read any of the follow-ups of hers, but she handles them as clinical studies and tells what fraction of them, gives anecdotes and tells what fractions have had such and such symptoms. But this is not a field that I think, at least at this time, is enough that you can call it well statistically founded. I do know, I listened to her speak when she came to Dartmouth, and she was complaining that they were in the process of revising the DSM-3B or whatever it was into the DSM-4, and she thought much more of it should be categorized as post-traumatic and was not having success in that. So the statistical bases are not that well established, but it's a significant number, and it's the unusual child who is completely free of that sort of stuff. And why it is that some kids get through, you don't know. Now there was a paper that was presented at MHA this last spring, and I don't recall the author. He used a paper that had come out of Maryland somewhere, describing something called post-traumatic growth. That some children actually can prosper and can actually show signs of significant growth by overcoming episodes of trauma. And without any data whatever, he was saying, obviously this is what Joseph Smith is because, and he went on to describe what Joseph Smith said about himself when he was an adult. And that's a problematic use of data, but there is something called post-traumatic growth that is beginning to be discussed right now. But you can't get away from the symptoms that these kids are showing.
The fact that the family abandoned them after the trauma that you point out.
Yeah.
Other questions?
The thing that comes up all the time is how could this uneducated young man write the Book of Mormon? It's one of the things that validates that it must be true.
And I have an attendant question with that too. Seeing Joseph in the text, which your work does beautifully, finding Joseph in the text, also in a way refutes the theories of him having plagiarized other people's works. That it actually defends the fact that Joseph, that the text is he. Like the Shakespeare authorship controversy. I mean, Joseph is the real creator of the text. I just wanted to add that.
I believe that absolutely. Okay. Except, of course, the Isaiah things. And he used the politics around him. He used the United States elections around him. But primarily his own personal history and primarily the whole family thing.
Mm-hmm. But to her question, how could a young, educated... Even though he is central and the text reflects his life and his family, how could he have done it?
I think it's an excellent question, but the issue I have is that he began to superimpose.
Can you take the mic up a little closer?
He began to develop and superimpose an artificial personality on top of whoever he was underneath. And this artificial superimposed personality was made up of all the revival information, all the Christianity in the book, and he elaborates grossly on all the stories within the family that we have. And it's like this is who he became, this elaborate spinning out of everything that was a superimposed personality.
Bob's not giving himself enough credit. If you read his entire book, he shows the chronology of the Book of Mormon and its geographic relationships as direct biographical episodes in the life of Joseph himself. And as Bob said, he started practicing from the time he was a young boy, and every night he was telling these stories to the family around the fireplace after dinner. He had those stories in hand, so when it came time to start dictating, he had the sequence all together and so forth. I had originally thought that this was dissociation, that he was in some kind of trance, and that's what I've got in my book. But Bob has convinced me that this is a very well-coordinated story that tells a clear chronology, and that's what you will get when you buy Bob's book.
Buy his too.
Brent. Yeah, I have one more too.
Comment on what Maxine was just saying. One of the other things that we do know about the book is that after he lost 116 pages, rather than going back and replacing those, he simply continues on with the dictation from Mosiah to the end of the book. Then once he finishes with either Ether or Moroni, I don't know which chronology model to go with, then he goes back and dictates 1 Nephi through the words of Mormon. But what's significant about that, going back to two things, one, how could anyone who's uneducated write this thing, and secondly, was he plagiarizing from Solomon Spaulding or someone else, is that the answer to the first one, well, yeah, of course he could do it, and I'll tell you why in a second, because it goes to the second point, and no, he did not plagiarize from anyone else. And the reason why is because when he goes back to redo the replacement section, he can't do it word for word. If he's plagiarizing from someone, he would have just grabbed the manuscript again and gone right back to it and replaced the whole thing, but he can't. And so that's when DNC 10 comes along and gives the explanation for why he can't, because somebody has stolen it, right? And they've changed the words.
There's two comments on this.
So anyway, it goes kind of to the heart of it, but he is the one, because it's happening right at the time.
It's original.
There's nobody else to be drawing on.
It's original.
It's
original.
The part of the problem was that he claimed that somebody else, in the scene when his head was facing the hat, someone else, a supernatural person, was doing the translation and he was just reading it off. That meant that if he went back and was to do it again, he had to get it word perfect because it had been given by a supernatural. The second thing of interest is evangelists and non-Mormons want to believe he stole the Spaulding manuscript. They're pushing it today as hard as they can. I reviewed this in the John Whitmer book in the last couple of years. They really want it because if they say this is a psychological issue and this is how a religion is created, you can turn around and say, well, what about you?
Exactly.
And to Bob, I just add one more point. It means that they believe the same thing that Mormons believe, and that is that Joseph Smith could not have written this book. That's the irony of the whole thing to me, right? They have to come up with someone else in order to explain it.
I have to sneak in one final question. Is Joseph more than his psychology? His pathology, especially. And if so, what? And these frameworks, frameworks, the psychological framework and the family systems or family relation framework, he's participating in those as the Book of Mormon is coming forth. But are there other frameworks equally influential and valid, such as the Bible and such as Jung's creative imagination, these other frameworks that could have been operating all at the same time? I know that's a huge question, and that's the last question.
Yes.
Oh, come on.
He's more than Joseph Smith. He's the founder of a major American religion that has reached power that can influence politics.
So is it possible there's more than psychology or pathology, that there's also a spirit operating inside of him?
Show me.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for an amazing session and for your brilliant, brilliant work on Jesus.